It's not hard to imagine on a day like this, is it? I too appreciated that song. Trust your testimony is that you are ever rejoicing in the bright sunlight. I want to start out with some help from you younger ones. I want you to help me list the five senses that we humans have. And I give you the option of telling me so I can write it on the board, or you can come up here and write it yourself. What are the five senses that God has given us? Raise your hand. Yes. Do you want to come up and write it? Who's next? We got one down. Taste. One out of five. Thank you. I think this is going to take some time. What other senses has God given you? You don't have to be shy. If you don't want to write it, I'll write it for you. Yes. Do you want to write it? I'll give you some time to decide. We got taste and smell. If you want to write it, just come up here. What are the others? We got three to go. This one stumps me sometimes too. Yes. Feel. Do you want to write it? Did you decide yet? Two more. These are the ones I expected to come out first. What are the other two senses that we have? Should I start calling names? Do you have one, Shakira? You say seeing? Do you want to write it? One more. Yes. Down hearing. That's what I was listening for, so I wasn't listening for listening. Should I write it for you? These are the five senses that God has given us: seeing, taste, feeling, hearing, and smell. Does anybody want to guess which one you use the most?
Hearing.
We got one guess on the floor. I applaud you for your willingness to guess. Seeing? 30 to 50% of our brain is used to process what we see. 8% is used to process what we feel, and 3% is used to process what we hear. Those numbers astounded me. But that's what scientists say. I was reading through Matthew 6 some time ago, and there was a phrase that really stuck out at me. And that's the title of our message. I'll take you to Matthew 6:23. It stuck out at me, and it also stuck with me. Our eye is created to receive information, but we are constantly bombarded with information, much more than we can ever actually see, so to speak. So our brain sorts through that information, decides what's important to us and what it wants and what we are going to think about. If you go with me to Matthew 6:23, I'm going to back up to verse 21. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Now, this is an integral verse to this discussion because where your treasure is, there will your heart be. There's things that we value, there's things that we're going to be seeing, there's things that our brain has created pathways to bring our attention to something. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. And that's why I was so blessed by that song, Walking in Sunlight, as our lives are immersed in the light, the heavenly light of the glory divine. Verse 23, but if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. And therefore the light that is in thee be darkness. How great is that darkness? And that phrase, if thine eye be evil, is the one that stuck out to me. I'm preaching to the weak brother this morning, and I'm preaching to the brother who thinks he's the strongest here this morning, and I'm definitely preaching to the brother behind the pulpit. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about the marvel of the eye. I already touched on that briefly, but Jesus created our sight, and he knew what he was talking about when he talked about how much of our world that we get from the light that comes through our eyes. One thing in my research I found very fascinating is that our sight actually overrules our hearing. And I watched a little video of a researcher who was trying to prove his point. So he just had a recording, well, it looked like he was saying it. He just had the simple sound of ba with the B sound. And he kept doing this. And then he switched to, you know, when you say the B sound, your lips connecting, and you put out the sound of the B. But imagine yourself making the sound of the F, where your teeth come down against your bottom lip. Well, he started doing that, and I instantly started hearing fa instead of ba. But they were making the same sound the entire time. And even knowing it, I still heard the F sound because my eyes were overruling what I was hearing. And that researcher said he's been studying it 25 years and it still works on him. Even when he's listening to himself in a recording like that. So our sight overrules our hearing. Supposedly we can identify an image if we only see it for 13 thousandths of a second. For me it's probably a little bit slower, but it might depend what it is. Advertisers know how important our sight is, and they take it to their advantage to try to control us to do what they want us to do. And one of the main things that they work with is color. And they say about 62 to 90% of our assessment of a person or product, our initial assessment, is based on color alone. Just that brief assessment. We see a picture or a sight, and we make an assessment on a product or an individual. I found it interesting in my study to say gender differences. They say you would not use the color purple to sell to a man, but you would use it to sell to a woman. And some of those gender differences are created within us. It's not something we choose necessarily. There's probably an exception to every rule, but across the board, the color purple in an advertisement would not appeal to a man. You have the color red. And I wonder if somebody can tell me what this is. Did anybody see one of these on the way to church this morning? Thank you. What color was it? Yes.
Red.
Red. I don't know if it's culture. I think it's more than just culture, but red often in our minds has the idea of danger, caution, and a heightened sense of urgency. On your stove, you probably have a red light that says your burner's on. When your burner comes on, there's a red glow that comes on, whether it's real or whether it's fake, I don't know. But this red glow comes on, it's a warning. Fire, it has a reddish hue to it. Blood. Somebody gets hurt. There's blood flowing. You have a sense of urgency. You have anger. You have fire engines. Some of that stuff is natural. Some of that stuff is culture. But red often signifies a sense of urgency. The color blue is calming. You think of a blue lake, a peaceful blue lake. You don't have the white caps. It's just a peaceful environment. And then as you look up, you see the beautiful blue sky, and it's a very calming picture. And blue they often use as a calming. They want you to picture a calm experience, an ideal experience. Well, color is not the only thing. They use movement. Movement catches their eyes. I don't know if you've ever been doing research on a website, and you're reading down through and suddenly a little ad pops up to the side and it's just moving all over the place. It's just a tiny little box. It takes up a very small portion of the page, but it's almost impossible to ignore. And if you really don't want to see it, it's just simply annoying. But it's doing its job. Our eyes also pick out things that are different. Different shapes. Different sizes, different orientations. See, our brain glosses over that which is normal. So when you see something long enough, like that verse at the top, I don't know if anybody read that this morning, but it's been there for a while. Maybe it's about time to change it, but it's been there for a while, and your eyes might gloss right over top of it. You probably didn't think about the patterns in the carpet this morning because they've been there for a long time. If somebody replaced one of those squares with a different pattern, your eyes would pick it out, even if it was the same color, because there's something different, and your eyes latch on to something that's different. Advertisers take advantage of this when they have to put something on their packaging that they do not want to put on. It's called the fine print. When they're legally required to put disclaimers on or cautions or warnings about their product, and they put it in very even, fine print with no additional color and no different shapes and sizes, anything but to catch your attention. And I went to think of the cigarette packs. So they made them put warnings on them. And this one here says, government warning, cigarettes are addictive. And it's just very plain text, right? Very easy to overlook and ignore and pretend it's not there. If you want to smoke a pack of cigarettes, not a big deal. You can gloss right over that. Well, it's addictive, big deal, right? For some people, wouldn't really matter. Then there's some countries, and they're trying to do it in this country, where they might put a picture of mouth cancer on the pack of cigarettes. Now, that is not something you can simply ignore. The two are not the same. They're both giving warnings, but the one is visual and the one is not. So that is how our brain works. And that's the last thing I would want to put on my product if I was selling a product, is a disclaimer, a visual disclaimer like that. When it comes to our sight and our brains, processing our sight, we train our brains to see what we're interested in seeing. Those things that we enjoy. I don't know if some of you probably saw the updates I posted of my time in Honduras. And all the different vehicles, especially the ones that would not have passed our inspections by a long shot. And some of the other creative ways of transportation caught my eye. It's something that I take interest in. I took the time to snap a photo of it. And I did think about it. It's very interesting as we think about how we bring in so much information through our sight compared to our other senses. We're quick to carry cameras. We're quick to pull out our phones and snap a picture. But how often do we pull out our phones and take a recording? Once in a while we do. But it's not very often, at least for myself. Much, much more likely to snap a picture than to snap a recording. So we train our brains to look for those things which interest us. And it might be a nice house. You're driving along and there's a big mansion up on the hill that catches your attention. Maybe it don't. Maybe it's a sports or a luxury car. Number one, it's out of the ordinary, and our brains do catch that which is out of the ordinary. You're probably not going to notice a tan Camry going down the road. But a bright blue Corvette, you probably will notice. At least some of us would. Not all of you. It might be antiques. It might be an immodestly dressed person. It might be a certain expensive clothing or a certain fad or style that's currently the thing to do. And if you care about styles and fads, you're going to pick that out immediately. It might be a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise, as we were encouraged to think about the beauty of nature in devotions this morning. It might be a certain brand of drink. That you like that drink, and when you're looking at all the drinks on the shelf, if you go to Sheetz, there's just an endless array of drinks, but there's a certain one you like, and that just pops right out at you. We train our brains to look for those things which interest us. We're also going to be much quicker to notice things that are a danger or a threat to us. Picture with me. If I had been mauled by a bear and almost lost my life, I never was, but if I had been, and you had never been, and you and I are walking through the woods together where there's bears, which of us is more likely to see the bear? I'm sure it'll be me because my brain has a very heightened sense of danger because of my experience. A person who witnessed the apostasy of the greater Mennonite church will see things that threaten what is valuable to them, and other people might not notice or care or see the problem. But to them, they have a heightened sense of danger, perchance. We are amazingly controlled by what we see. More than we can ever understand or imagine. So how does that affect us spiritually? And that takes us to our second point, the lust of the eye. When I think about if thine eye be evil, my mind goes to the lust for that which is immodest. But it's more than that. In fact, in the context of our verse here, our text verse, Matthew 6:23, it's actually talking about covetousness. Yearning for that which is not ours. Yearning for that, wanting those things that should not be ours. That could definitely include the earlier, but it's much broader and wider than that. The lust of the eye. 1 John 2:15-17. Love not the world. See, there's things that are valuable to us. He's starting right in with that idea. What is our love? Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. It's going to be either one or the other. We cannot have both. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. So we see here that those things that captivate our attention, that draw us, that make us want the forbidden. Understand, lust is simply wanting that which is forbidden. If we allow ourselves to be drawn in by the forbidden, that is not of the Father, that is of the world. And we know that those things that are forbidden, that we are drawn to, those things that capture our lusts, are going to pass away. They're so temporal. They have no value. They have no lasting value to them. Just as in the beauty of youth turns into... There's beauty in old age too, don't get me wrong, but there's something about the beauty of youth that is so fleeting. The world passeth away and the lust thereof. The lust of the world passes away, but doing the will of God. He says here that if we do the will of God, that we will abide forever. Those are the things that will last. Those are the things that we should desire. As we think about lust being that which is forbidden, or wanting that which is forbidden, I want to ask you, who said this? Yea, hath God said? Satan said that. And Satan has a way of questioning that which is forbidden. God says, of this tree ye shall not eat. It's a very simple rule. And Satan comes along and says, yeah, did God say that? And then Satan went on to say, this is actually good for you. That which God says you should not have is actually good for you. And Satan fed that lie into Adam and Eve's mind, and they believed it. Yea, hath God said. Satan wants to convince us that God is holding enjoyable things from us. That if we would take that which is forbidden, that we could actually have a more enjoyable life. And that is a lie straight from Satan. Because we know that if we submit to our Creator and if we desire those things that He would have for us, after all, He's the one that made us. He knows what makes us joyful and happy. It's only then that we can find true joy in life. It is submission to God's will in a life of holiness that brings true joy. Satan knows how much we're influenced. Just like those advertisers know how much we're influenced by what we see, so does Satan. Satan takes a creation that God has called good. He tries to tempt us to enjoy that creation in a way that is opposite of holiness. The text verse here comes from Matthew 6:23. And if you go back a couple of verses, he's talking about treasures. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. See, if we treasure those things that make for a richer, easier lifestyle, advertisers tell us that we need their product to make us happy. We need to stop and ask, is it true? Are we trying to lay up wealth so that we can live happily ever after? Is the possessions, is our hard-earned money, are we laying those things up? Or maybe we're spending it all on those treasures that we want. Maybe we're spending more than what we earned for treasures that we want. Whatever it is. Is it so that we can live happily ever after? Is it to please myself? Is it to fulfill the lusts of the world? Maybe your struggle is a lust for immodesty. Now, I have several tests here, so we ponder whether we have this struggle. And one thing I find out sometimes is I'm scrolling through the news, as I might be reading the news on my phone, I'm scrolling up through it, an immodest picture pops up. What do I do? Do I open it up to see if there's more things that I can see to feed my lust? Or do I just pause for a few seconds to enjoy the picture and then move on? Or do I scroll faster to get that off my screen? Or maybe I just get rid of the app entirely. Maybe you're driving down the road and there's an immodestly dressed person out for a stroll. Do you take the time to enjoy the picture that is in front of you, and as you drive past, you check the rearview mirror? Or maybe you just watch for a second to get the full picture. Or maybe you avert your gaze to a different area so that you are not tempted to fill your mind with lust. Perhaps you have access to the internet. Perhaps it's even unfiltered for some reason. What do you search? As we ask ourselves these questions, and it's a good test to see where we're at on this struggle. Finally, I want to look at the cure. If thine eye is evil, what is the cure? And we go back here to Matthew 6:22. The light of the body is the eye. We see that the information that we get, the light that we fill our lives with, comes through our eye. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. So the cure that I see is an eye full of light. Now I don't proclaim to understand exactly what the phrase means, if thy eye be single. It's only used twice in the New Testament, and it's used in the same context, in the Gospel of Luke, where he's also reciting the same thing that Jesus said. So it's only used basically once, and it has the idea of simple. Some people say it's a translation thing from the Aramaic to the Greek, and perhaps it meant a good eye versus a bad eye. Some people have researched that and come to that conclusion. But I believe the context of this verse makes it very simple to understand what Jesus means by if thine eye be single. Could be focused on that which God wants us to see. The good things, the holy things. And in Luke 11, the sister passage to this here in Matthew 6, Luke writes, the light of the body is the eye. Therefore, when thine eye is single, thy whole body also is full of light. If thy body therefore be full of light, having no part dark, the whole shall be full of light, as when the bright shining of a candle doth give thee light. So we see here the answer to the lust for an evil eye or an eye of darkness is an eye that is full of light, so that our body can be full of light. There is no darkness, there is no evil in an eye that is full of light. Just as our brains can be trained to look for those things that are wrong, that are lustful, that are forbidden, so we can train our brains to look for the beauty, the good things, the sunsets, the beautiful leaves in the fall, the beauty around us, the beauty of others as we relate to others around us. It is very important to replace evil thoughts with good thoughts, because Jesus gave the example of an evil, unclean spirit, he said, that left a man. And I don't proclaim to understand the spirit world like Jesus would have, but he said this unclean spirit left this man, and this unclean spirit went around trying to look for a place to rest, and it could not find any. So it came back to this man and found out that this man that he had, this unclean spirit had left, was swept, was clean, but it was empty. So he's able to move right back in. But he did not only just move back in, he brought other seven other spirits that were even more wicked than what that spirit was. So now this man had eight spirits, and it says his end was worse than the beginning. And so it is very important that we not only cast out that which is wrong, but that we also fill it with that which is right. We need to see our possessions as God's. As we think of the snare of covetousness, lust is much more than just simply immodesty. It could be coveting that which is not ours, or coveting that which we don't need, or coveting that which is forbidden. We need to see our possessions as God and ask God how he wants us to use them. When we see an advertisement that's beckoning us to purchase one more thing, we need to stop and ask, would God want me to use his money to buy that? Would God want his money spent on that particular item? We also, as we fill our minds with light, we need to see people as humans in need of the offer of God's salvation. This is the opposite of seeing people in a lustful way that can fulfill the lusts of my flesh. It is not the same. People are not an object to satisfy my lust. People are humans in need of God's offer of salvation. We need to look others in the eye, keep our gaze up. See, a selfish person will use others to satisfy his own lust. And that is so carnal. And our carnal man, we know it is so real to us. A selfless person, the opposite of a selfish person. You didn't know it was a selfishness problem, did you? The selfless person will think about ministering to others, and they will see a different person than what the selfish person sees. As we think of filling our eyes with that which is good, we need to take responsibility for ourselves. There's so many people that will blame others. Well, there have been thieves that have made the confession that if he wouldn't have had it there, if he wouldn't have had it where I could see it, I wouldn't have stole it. And if I wouldn't have stole it, somebody else would have. And they rationalize and they push the blame off so that they themselves are not responsible for the choice they made to covet and then to steal. When it comes to taking responsibility for yourself, there was a quote I read yesterday in the Fish Wrapper. I didn't look it up. I should have looked it up again, exactly what it was, but I got the point. When looking for faults, we prefer windows, not mirrors. So when we're looking for faults, we're much quicker to look through the glass that we can see through rather than the one that shows ourselves. We need to own our own sin and not blame others. If we have a temptation to sin, we need to tell someone and get help. I'm going to take you to Matthew 7. If you're in Matthew 6, it's just right across the page. Matthew 7, 3 to 5. Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye? And behold, a beam is in thine own eye. Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. This follows two verses on judging. And we see here that it is important to help our brother to cast out the mote. But it is much more important that I look in the mirror and see myself and take responsibility for myself. That is where we need to start. Do I know what others should do, but I don't do it myself? Be very careful about going places where you will be tempted, where you know you're going to be tempted in a weak area. A person who struggles to abstain from drunkenness would be very foolish to walk into a bar. His senses would tempt him in a way he probably would not be able to stand up to. One who struggles with purity would be foolish to go to a summer beach. One who struggles with obesity would be foolish to go to an all-you-can-eat buffet. Be careful about going places where you will be tempted. And if you know you're going to go to, you need to go to a place where you will very likely be tempted. You need to be prepared. Don't put wicked things before your eyes. And that comes from Psalm 101. I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. Verse 3, I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. And we see here a man that is purposeful. He's making decisions to not put himself in a place where he would be lusting after the forbidden. If you're in Matthew 5, just drop back to Matthew. If you're in Matthew, drop back to Matthew 5, verses 27 to 29. Ye have heard that it hath been said. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. So we know that adultery is sin. Adultery is an intimate relationship with a person whom we are not married to. But I say unto you, whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Even if I am imagining, even if I am the lust of my flesh, if I'm looking on a woman wishing that I could do that which is forbidden, I have committed adultery in my heart. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee, again, that one of thy members should perish, and not that the whole body should be cast into hell. I don't know of anybody who has taken verses 29 and 30 literal. The apostles did not teach that people should literally remove their eye or their arm. The early Christian church leaders, neither did they. But we get the concept. The concept is very obvious to us. In our day, we could replace it with, it would be better to have a dumb phone than to go to hell and perish there. If you are tempted by a phone app, cut it off. Or have a brother help you with accountability. We know that the world uses the forbidden to sell their product. They want to keep your attention. They know if they use the forbidden, they're going to keep your attention. It works. Apart from God's strength. Movies glorify the forbidden to attract viewers. Online games sexualize the characters to pull players further into addiction, as if the competition was not enough. And as we follow our brotherhood guidelines, the guardrails that are put up, it does help to protect us, but it needs to go much further than that. We need to be men and women of character. We said no to the television, but are we watching movies on YouTube? Or worse? How might God rate my online activity on a scale of 1 to 10? So if God would come up here and if I would come up here and put the numbers 1 through 10, and God would come down and rate your online activity on that scale of 1 being evil and 10 being righteous, where would you be on that scale? And it's one of those things that we need to ponder in our own hearts and take responsibility for. Remember to be intentional to put right things, to put good things before our eyes. We need to be intentional. As we take responsibility for ourselves, we also take responsibility for our families, especially you fathers of the homes. A mother knows that if she wants healthy children, she needs to feed them healthy food. And if you fathers want spiritually healthy children, you need to make sure, you need to be responsible that your children are receiving spiritually healthy food. It's not complicated. It is your responsibility. You are responsible for your children. You need to know what they are consuming. I had a friend who grew up with very little internet control. His father did not see a need for it, and it worked for him. He thought it would work for his son, but his son developed a porn addiction at a very young age, and it ruined the life of his son and also his own life in many ways. And I can only imagine how the grandfather wishes he would have taken purity, the limits and accountability on internet more seriously. It might work for you, but it might not work for somebody else. Take responsibility for others. Don't buy something that might be a snare to others. Our church has guardrails for the weak. And I may be able to handle something, but my brother might not. And Paul told us what to do if that is the case. We give up things that we could handle so that my brother is not tempted. am I willing to do without? And in light of that, we tend to think of ourselves as being strong, but we make very poor judges of our own strength, of our own character. Buy things that can be of simple service to our Creator. Do not dress or behave in a way that is a temptation to others. The world says that they can dress as scantily as they wish. And if somebody is tempted by the way they choose to dress, it is not their problem. That is false. That is not true. Yes, we do need to take responsibility for ourselves, no matter what anybody else chooses to do. But we also need to take responsibility for others, and we should not dress in a way that would cause somebody else to stumble. Dress in a way that brings glory to God with the virtues of modesty and simplicity. Make sure we are not drawing glory to ourselves. I want to take you to Hebrews 12, kind of wrap up this sermon. One, if thine eye be evil, or if thy body is able to be full of light. In Hebrews 11, we know is a faith chapter. Where there's a list of man after man who followed God, who submitted to God's will for his life, who obeyed God, and through that showed his faith. And we can see the faith of these men. And then chapter 12, verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, we are never alone. We are compassed about with a great cloud of witnesses. And seeing that, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. I am human. I am a man. I am very familiar with the sin that does so easily beset us. Let us lay that aside. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. See, there's a purposeful decision to look on that which is right. Looking unto Jesus, what better way could you do to solve the problem of if thine eye be evil? Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. He was willing to endure suffering, despising this shame, and to sit down at the right hand of the throne of God. Thinking of that, despising the shame. I am not endorsing getting into politics this morning. But when I see a politician that's ridiculed for his decision to never meet with a woman alone without his wife along, and other people ridicule him for that, he carries a shame for his decision. Jesus here despised that shame. He ignored it. And he is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood. They had not yet given their lives, striving against sin. We see here that sin is something that we're constantly striving against. We need to be purposeful and strong against sin. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, my son. Despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. I want to drop down to verse 11. Now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. When we are denied or punished, denied those things that we believe would bring us happiness and joy, that can be grievous, especially when those things seem to be rightfully ours. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness, the peaceable fruit of living right, unto them which are exercised thereby. Have you been exercised by the chastening of the Lord? Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet. Do you see the purposefulness of somebody who's determined to make straight paths for their feet? They're taking responsibility for themselves. Lest that which is lame be turned out of the way. Now I get the impression here is a person who's making straight paths for their own feet, but they're also concerned about those who are lame, who might be coming on behind. And as they make a straight path, they're also taking responsibility for others. And make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. There's a little phrase stuck in here, almost as an afterthought. And holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. And it just raises this idea of holiness on a pedestal much higher than what we tend to put it. Without holiness, we are not going to see the Lord. It is not hard to understand what that phrase means. Perhaps when we are tempted by what we see, you might think like I have. If thine eye be evil. That's a phrase that has stuck in me after I read it. I don't know why it stuck out to me more than it has other times I read that verse, but that is a phrase that has resonated in my mind when I was tempted. If thine eye be evil. I don't want an evil eye. I want that to be far from me. I want an eye that's full of light. I want a life that's full of holiness. I want the heavenly sunlight beaming into my life, as we read about, flooding my soul with glory divine. Hallelujah. I am rejoicing. Sing his praises. Jesus is mine. As somebody who has Jesus' presence in their lives, the darkness has been chased out as Jesus' light has come in. Allow God to cleanse your heart. Be proactive to fill your heart and your life and your eyes with righteous things. Be children of the light. Be strong enough to eschew evil. Just come to the Lord in prayer.